Okay, I wrote this song for a Jewish climate rally, and I rewrote it for labor notes. Any Jews in the crowd? Very well represented at a labor conference. Okay, so it's getting warmer across the whole planet, and the waters are rising, goddammit, and parts of the country will be under the sea, creating wars of destruction for our children to be. And the worst part is that we've known the whole time our leaders betrayed us for pennies, nickels, dimes, and all we've got now are statements that are vague. God, we've found our pharaohs, now where are the plagues? And Mirvan Zeiber Levin, oh Mirvan Zeiber Levin, Mirvan Zeiber Levin, we will outlive them, we will survive. Meanwhile, your rent is still coming, and the landlord won't fix the stove or the plumbing. The hospitals will kill you if you can't pay, and the government will throw you in prison for the rest of your days. Our pharaohs will tell you all about sustainability and compromise. Please don't forget the civility. But the UN is saying we've got less than 20 years, and that change will require some billionaires' tears. And Mirvan Zeiber Levin, oh Mirvan Zeiber Levin, Mirvan Zeiber Levin, we will outlive them, we will survive. It's easy to get hopeless thinking about the situation. You know, the end of the days creates quite the complications. With lives being lost, wind knocking down the doors, it's worth remembering that we've seen horrors before. There's an old tale about some Jews caught by the Nazis. They're back against the wall, not a way out that they could see. The Jews were requested to dance before they were dead. Well, one stepped forward, and here's what he said. He said, Mir, Veln, Zeiber Levin. He said, Mir, Veln, Zeiber Levin. He said, Mir, Veln, Zeiber Levin. We will outlive them. We will survive. As the bombs getting dropped kill another few million, and the genocidal profiteers who are doped by the billions will step forward, stand up, we won't be afraid. We'll move forward proudly, we're courageous and brave. Yeah, we'll build out a union and sing out this chorus. We'll shut down their factories so they can't ignore us. No one to save us but you and me. Yeah, we'll fight and we'll strike until we part the sea. Yeah, we'll build out a union and sing out this chorus. We'll shut down their factories so they can't ignore us. No one to save us but you and me. I will fight and we'll strike until we part the sea. Mirvan Zeiber Levin, Mirvan Zeiber Levin, Mirvan Zeiber Levin, we will outlive them, we will survive. Solidarity forever. Yeah, we'll fight and strike and part the sea.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Joe Clement, your host. That was a recording of Ben Moss Horowitz singing an original song based on a real phrase and events from World War II at the 2022 Labor Notes Conference Great Labor Arts Exchange Concert, which I was present for. It's become something of a holiday song we play in our house during Passover. To that end, today is the fifth day of Passover, or Pesach, one of the most important holidays in the Jewish calendar. As a story, it's about the ancient Jewish experience of slavery in Egypt and liberation from it. A central Passover tradition is the Seder, a ceremonial retelling of the story through words, song, and eating ritual food before a festive meal. It has not only been a core part of Judaism for thousands of years, but it has been an inspiration of freedom struggles in recent generations. My partner Mar, who is Jewish, has not only been to several more typically private seders, including ones we host, but has helped organize public seders through Jewish Voice for Peace in the spirit of Rabbi Arthur Waskow's 1969 Freedom Seder, So I wanted to have them on to talk about the Passover story in light of Jewish anti-Zionism, Seder traditions, and working toward freedom and liberation for all peoples. Thanks for joining me, Mar.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
Well, before we jump into our conversation, could you say a bit about your story coming into a renewed Jewish identity through anti-Zionism, what Seders or Pesach have meant to you, and how that connects with what JVP is doing now?
So my parents were immigrants from the Soviet Union in the late 70s, so they grew up quite secular and immigrated to Brooklyn, and that's when I was born. And they were fairly alienated from the Jewish community in New Jersey, which is where I mostly grew up, partly because of the dues structure of synagogues. They were working class and immigrants. And then when I began at university, it was when I really started learning about the Palestine. I just had not known really anything about the struggles that Palestinians faced and the ongoing apartheid conditions in Israel. And that just really turned me off to Judaism even more, especially also being a woman at that time and having a queer identity. Just really had been turned off from Judaism. And it wasn't until about 2020 or 2021, through a series of classes that I took with Rain Crow, who is a local priestess and teacher. She teaches a series of classes, one on Caliban and the Witch, or The Burning Times Never Ended, and this class called Longing to Belong. And that was one of the first times that I was with a group of anti-Zionist Jews. And it was a really profound experience for me. I had always considered myself a spiritual person and felt this call from my ancestors that there was still something within Judaism for me to explore. And so I got involved with our Reconstructionist synagogue here in Portland, and I began meeting other anti-Zionist Jews. And then I got involved with Jewish Voice for Peace at the beginning of 2024. And I would say that all along throughout the early part of my life, I have always loved Passover because it is the time that we really celebrate freedom and this incredible story from the Exodus. And I think that a lot of people, even if they're not connected with Judaism, really connect with Passover. For one, it's a home holiday. It's one of the only holidays within Judaism that is not part of a synagogue. It's people celebrate it in their homes, and there are lots of kind of interesting things that we do during Passover. And most importantly, for I think a lot of us, getting to celebrate freedom and that experience of liberation is pretty impactful.
You mentioned, you know, there's many different parts to Passover and to the Seder itself. Could you say a bit about what the Seder is, what goes into it? It's part ritual, part meal, part storytelling, but it's been happening in a pretty consistent way for thousands of years. What are the main highlights of the Seder?
Yeah, so Seder actually means order. So there are lots of different things that happen, but some of the important ones are we drink wine. We have four cups. Wine, I think, really does represent like coming together, expressing gratitude for the fruit of the vine, and just kind of relaxing into a space of family and community. But I guess what I'll say, first of all, before I get even more into all the different parts, I think what really makes it a Seder is that we tell the story of the Exodus, and we have to tell it as if it is us living through slavery and living through the experience of being liberated. A crucial part of any Seder is that it's multi-generational. We tell this story to our children. There are lots of parts of the Seder that appeal specifically to children. And we eat matzah. You know, the story with the matzah is that our people were in such a rush to leave Egypt, which we call Mitzrayim, kind of the narrow place We're leaving the narrow place, and we had to do it in such a hurry that we didn't have time for the dough to rise. So the matzah baked flat. And it is a reminder of that moment. And so with all of the ritual foods, the reason why we eat them and prepare them and display them in that way is because we really do want to experience what it was like. You know, we eat that dry cracker-like matzah, and we dip the parsley. The parsley sort of represents spring, which is the time that Passover comes in, and we dip parsley in salt water to remember the tears of our ancestors. And we have that experience of eating bitter foods and sort of unpleasant, dry, salty, bitter foods to help us feel in our bodies what that experience might have been like for our ancestors. And we tell the story, and every family has their own different traditions for telling it and how what parts they highlight. But oftentimes there's some theatricality involved, like props or acting things out or having an opportunity to just discuss the different parts of the Exodus story and reflect on them. And especially think about how we still are in some ways experience the loss of freedom or experience oppression. So other parts of the Seder include, there's this section where they talk about four different kinds of children, and also the four questions. And so this is one of the parts, like I mentioned, that it appeals specifically to children. There's a tradition in many families where the youngest child is supposed to recite the four questions. So there's some preparation involved. There's ritual hand washing. We eat different foods like horseradish, again, to represent the bitterness of slavery. And there's this food called haroset, which is chopped up apples with wine and nuts. And it represents the bricks and the mortar that the Hebrew slaves used to build.
Well, before we get into more of the details about the Seder itself, I'd like to just recap the story of the Exodus. It is part myth and legend with elements of history. The ancient Jews were in Egypt, and their numbers were growing, and the Pharaoh at the time, Ramesses II, grew concerned that they would become a powerful constituency. So he had them enslaved. Under enslavement, a prophecy arose that one of them would lead a revolt against the Pharaoh. And so the Pharaoh had all of the firstborn of the Hebrews killed. The midwives of Egypt, who might have been Jewish, might have been Egyptian, refused to do this and came up with an excuse. Under the cover of that excuse, one of these children was hidden away in the reeds of the Nile River. When Pharaoh's daughter recovered him, he was raised in Pharaoh's court as one of his own and eventually came to know his identity as one of the Jews and became disgusted with the slave society that he was born into and was somehow living on top of. And he killed one of the slave drivers and fled and had a wife with one of the neighboring tribes and had a calling from God to come back and liberate his people, the so-called burning bush episode. And he came back and he reunited with his family, his brother Aaron and his sister Miriam and his mother Yocheved, and tried to reason with Pharaoh, who refused, and so God sent 10 plagues, and these plagues all have a kind of earthly element, and so they strike, I think, listeners and readers today as kind of foretelling climate change, apocalypse, and Pharaoh eventually allows them to leave, and they famously leave through the Reed Sea. Moses parts the sea, and as they escape through it to the other side, Pharaoh follows them and is eventually killed when the sea collapses back in on them. Could you say more about the Freedom Seder, where it comes from, and what it has meant as both a bridge between modern freedom struggles and renewing Jewish practice?
Well, I think what I really would love to talk about is the ways in which people today are taking the Freedom Seder and applying it to their context. So, for example, in Jewish Voice for Peace, for the last 3 years, we've held a community liberation Seder where we do all of the things that make a Passover Seder, but we invite the community and we bring Palestine to the center of the conversation. And we believe, like so many other radical leftist Jews who spoke up for justice before us, that no one is free unless we're all free. And it is, I think for many of us anti-Zionist Jews, it's incredibly painful to celebrate a holiday that commemorates our freedom and liberation when the state of Israel is committing the atrocities of genocide and so much more in the name of the Jewish people or in the name of Jewish safety. And so that's what me and many other anti-Zionist Jews have committed ourselves to during Passover, is being able to uplift the Palestinian struggle for freedom and tie it in with our own histories of oppression, exploitation, and really uplift this central idea that none of us are free unless we're all free.
In what ways have Jews been innovating and inventing more rituals around the Seder?
One easy example is the additions that people have created on the Seder plate itself, like different ritual objects, different symbols, in ways of including other people that have been marginalized. And I would love to share the story of the orange on the Seder plate. I think it was Susanna Heschel. She was inspired by a group of women from Oberlin College in the early 80s who added, well, in her story, it was a piece of bread, which is totally not kosher for Passover. My teacher actually was part of that group of women in Oberlin College, and they basically, the story went that one of the lesbians in their collective, when she was a teenager, had asked her rabbi, what is the place of for lesbians within Judaism? And he got very angry and said, lesbians belong in Judaism like bread belongs on the Seder plate. But of course, they didn't want to add bread because that would make their whole table trife or not kosher. And so they added something called makom, which is just a space. And it was a space to recognize those who had been marginalized, like the lesbian in their collective. And Susanna Heschel had heard this story and decided to place an orange on the Seder plate to commemorate the incredible contributions that gay and lesbian Jews have given to Judaism. And the way she describes it is, you know, the orange is, you know, as a fruit, it multiplies. And yes, it also has seeds, and that's an opportunity to kind of spit out, you know, the plague of homophobia, so to speak. And that tradition has really spread. I think a lot of Jews now incorporate an orange on the Seder plate to represent LGBTQ people and women and other people with those type of marginalized identities. Those of us in the Palestine Solidarity Movement will add an olive to the Seder plate to represent the olive trees that are so important to the people of Palestine and also have been threatened by settler colonial violence. People have added a tomato to represent the farm workers and to be able to give gratitude to the farm workers and also to speak to the struggles that they have and more generally in the labor movement.
How do you think that
this has led to women and queer people being like prominent leaders and champions and drivers of the Palestine Solidarity Movement, as well as other movements for freedom and liberation outside of this context.
I mean, I think women and queer folks and trans people and people with marginalized identities understand oppression, understand exploitation, marginalization. So there's an empathy there. And within Judaism, you know, there's it's the patriarchy. I mean, it's one of the originals. And so, you know, there is a long history and tradition of women not being included in rituals, in anything that where there is, you know, where it's like a sacred act, like a mitzvah. And so it has become over time, you know, another front in the movement for different kinds of liberation. And so there's just a natural, I think, bridge there.
But it isn't just that Israel is still or is oppressing Palestine. It's the empire and Pharaoh in various forms, you know, exists throughout the world. United States is the great Pharaoh of the world, but not the only one.
Absolutely. I mean, American Jews have this almost like double complicity because supposedly, you know, these atrocities, genocide, and now war in Iran and Lebanon are being committed for Jewish safety and paid for through American taxpayer dollars. And we also see the way that our neighbors here in the U.S. are being impacted by ICE and certainly don't have freedom. Many of our neighbors don't have the freedom to leave their homes without being afraid of being kidnapped. So it is, you know, we're living under this, the boot of empire, you know, in this time of incredible crisis. So to be able to celebrate Passover and to celebrate our liberation, there's really no way to do that without also praying for and uplifting the voices of our neighbors in our community who don't have freedom right now, who don't have liberation or safety.
Before we wrap up, how can folks get involved with Palestine-Israel solidarity work or with anti-Zionist Jewish community?
Yeah, there's lots of Palestine solidarity work happening in Portland, depending on how you want to get involved. I work with Jewish Voice for Peace. You can find us online on our website or on Instagram. And, you know, shoot us an email, let us know that you want to get involved, and we can support you in getting connected. Also, DSA has a working group, a Palestine Solidarity working group, BDS, which stands for Boycott, Divest, and Sanctions. And there are Palestine groups on different campuses around Portland. So there's also Al-Auda, which is a Palestine-led organization, as well as others. But I think the important thing is just keeping Palestine at the center. It is very, very common to, you know, we saw it during the last election cycle, basically throw this issue under the bus. That is just not a winning strategy. We have to keep, you know, those who are experiencing the most marginalization at the center of our collective struggles for liberation.
Well, that's all the time we have for this conversation. I've been talking with Mar Zusman about the Jewish holiday of Passover and its celebration of freedom from slavery for thousands of years.